Welcome back. I hope you've enjoyed the series and the previous bonus episodes. In this one, we're going to examine why playfulness and play became such important ideas for Brody and Johnson. Having thought about their project for many, many years, I'm still not sure whether this was the right solution to their concerns, or rather whether it was the only acceptable solution given the very peculiar situation, unable to fit into either the military or the industry that they found themselves in. In any event, the ideas that led them to embrace play and playfulness are fascinating and still very much relevant today. And just like last time, this bonus episode will be in the format of a mini lecture by yours truly. Like last time, we'll have 5 interrelated chapters to go through, so off we go. Chapter 1, The Worldview. I've titled this first chapter The Worldview for a very simple reason. One can't really understand Brody and Johnson's fascination with playfulness without considering the very peculiar outlook that they had on the world in general. For them, the world is irreducibly complex, emergent and non-linear, many of its key processes circular and always affecting each other. Everything is connected to everything else and is constantly in flux. Our universe never stops the process of becoming. That is, the process of becoming something else, something different. This permanent fluidity means that ideas, languages, and tools are traditional ways of taming this complexity, often fail to catch up with the ever-changing reality around us. As a result, we often become our tools' unwilling prisoners, our concepts and mental frameworks turning stale and irrelevant. Thus, to keep pace with the ever-changing world, we must proactively seek and introduce new ways of thinking. As Brody puts it in the title of one of his articles, we must be constantly unlearning the obsolescent. By the way, this insight about the inevitable obsolescence of our mental frameworks led Brody to develop the important concept of developmental education. He defines it as discovering the ways of discovering of what one has never experienced. This is quite a mouthful, I know, so let me repeat that. Developmental education is about discovering the ways of discovering of what we have never experienced. I hope that you can see the echoes of his broader human enhancement agenda here. Developmental education is particularly important in our social life. Families, for instance, should develop the skill to adapt, to abandon outdated routines, and develop new responses to new situations. If they want to survive, families cannot possibly hope to continue as automated factories. They need to learn to be in contact with the world to turn noise into meaning. But one cannot do it by following the usual routines, the way one might in a science lab. The kind of novelty that Brody wants cannot be invented by an algorithm or a committee. These kinds of methodical interventions do not work in a world as fluid and complex as ours. This, by the way, applies not just to novelty, but to problem-solving too. When faced with a complex situation, the right solution isn't to try to reverse engineer all the factors that led to that particular problem. Our life, after all, is not like a clock or some other mechanical gadget. A gadget that one can take apart, see what's wrong, fix it, and then reassemble it back. In a complex and always changing world like ours, such engineering operations are outright impossible. The only viable way forward is by trying to grasp the hidden dynamics of a system and finding the right way to intervene in them. This, by the way, is what skilled psychiatrists do. They identify patterns, make patients aware of them, and hope that some kind of redirection would occur. Such kind of steering is exactly what cybernetics would prescribe. After all, the initial meaning of that mysterious term, cybernetics, is the science of governing. Responsive technologies and intelligent environments play a vital role in helping us spot and eliminate such unhelpful patterns. In a way, they're like surrogate psychiatrists. Acting as mediators of novelty, they help us grasp and integrate new information, all while revealing previously invisible patterns. Patterns that used to hold us back. Patterns that we can discard as we opt for new ways of being and seeing. Technology, in other words, can be a facilitator of developmental education. That romantic art of discovering the ways of discovering of what one has never experienced. And according to Brody, there's no better way to accelerate such discovery than to engage our playful side. More on this later. Chapter 2. Constructivist Development. Yes, this chapter has a complicated title. I just want to emphasize the similarities between our two protagonists, Brody and Johnson, and this other, much more famous couple, the psychologist and philosopher Jean Piaget, and his one-time collaborator, Seymour Papert. You might recall that I briefly mentioned Piaget and Papert in the main episodes, as both of them have a connection to Ozer. Just to refresh your memory, Pierre Ozer, a close friend of Seymour Papert, sat on Piaget's seminars in Geneva, and many of his other friends moved in the Piaget universe. Now, Brody had a Piaget connection of his own. From what he told me, the Swiss psychologist tried to recruit him to work in Geneva. Brody declined. Too boring, he wrote to me decades later. I did check Piaget's archives and the two did correspond. Judging by one letter, they must have met in May 1964. Piaget's output has been truly prodigious, and I won't attempt to summarize it here. There are, however, two important dimensions to his work that will help us better understand Brody and Johnson. The first big idea has to do with the notion of equilibration, a very important concept in Piaget. This was his way of saying that novel information often presents children with all sorts of cognitive challenges. It frequently throws them off, resulting in disequilibrium. So naturally, they have this inbuilt desire to tame novelty and seek equilibration. By the way, if you are familiar with cybernetics, of which Piaget was a big fan, you'll notice the similarities to the notion of homeostasis. Now, there are two ways of achieving equilibration. One is called assimilation. This is the process of fitting new information into pre-existing mental constructs. Let's say the child has previously seen tractors, but has never seen an excavator. So on seeing it for the first time, the child thinks that the excavator is just a slightly different tractor. Thus, a novel idea is assimilated into the pre-existing one. But there's also the second way of seeking equilibration, accommodation. This is when novelty pushes children to modify their existing mental schemes. Thus, it's not just a matter of fitting novel information into pre-existing concepts and structures. So in the example of the excavator, if someone points out that this is not a tractor, the child might need to modify their existing mental scheme of big work machines in order to make space for both tractors and excavators. Now, don't be misled by this particular example. One can easily imagine situations where assimilation doesn't lead to any cognitive errors. In fact, it's the right approach to pursue. Just think how richer the category of, say, butterfly becomes as the child spends a summer in the countryside. As you probably know, Piaget's experimental work focused on children. However, these insights about accommodation versus assimilation are surely applicable to adults too. Now, this is where it gets interesting. In principle, Brody is in agreement with Piaget. Both assimilation and accommodation are two common strategies of dealing with novelty. The real difference between them is in how they conceive of and problematize changes in the environment. The Swiss psychologist is much more focused on the organism. The environment is not of great theoretical interest to him. For Brody, on the other hand, the environment is very important. As you might remember from the previous chapter, he thinks that our world is changing, evolving, and becoming. Thus, even if we don't make any errors in classifying things around us, we would always need to be reclassifying them and revising our mental schemes. In other words, in Brody's plastic and always emerging universe, there is a strong bias towards accommodation. It's a more fitting strategy for metabolizing novelty. It makes sense. Since everything is always moving, we should always be questioning our existing categories and mental structures. Besides, on top of this philosophical argument about the world always being in flux, Brody had this historical argument about industrial capitalism and mass production. Both of them imprison us in static, one-size-fits-all physical structures. And these hard, unchangeable constraints, in turn, make it harder for us to practice accommodation. We find it difficult to constantly question the truths that, for some odd reason, we still hold to be self-evident. Hence Brody's insistence on developmental education. So for philosophical and historical reasons, Brody just cannot accept a universe where assimilation and accommodation hold equal importance. The latter is so much more important. That's why all sorts of techniques and tricks, including responsive technologies and intelligent environments, have to be mobilized. Without them, we would all be like people in those dreaded automated factories, assimilating novelty using pre-existing schemes, completely blind to all the change and novelty around us. Now, there's another big idea in Piaget. It has to do with his stage theory of cognitive development. Before I explain it, though, I should note that Piaget fashioned himself an applied epistemologist. That is, his work in psychology was more of a prelude to developing an empirically rich account of how we come to reason the way we do. So the theory about the stages of cognitive development sought to explain the evolution of our reasoning from immature to mature. He identified four stages in children's cognitive development. They varied from the very first stage, grounded in the movements and perceptions of the body, to the very last stage, grounded in abstract reasoning, where the bodily inputs seem to play almost no role. This theory implied a certain gain and progress in moving from what the Swiss psychologist called concrete and object-mediated intelligence to the kind of intelligence that is abstract and formal. It's this belief in the superiority of abstract and formal over concrete and object-mediated thinking that one young collaborator of Piaget put into question. His name? Seymour Papert, one of the pioneers of artificial intelligence. He also became known as an advocate for constructionist learning. This was the kind of learning where concrete and object-mediated operations were used to encourage students to discover what it is that they had to learn. At a broader level, though, Papert argued that there's nothing wrong with concrete thinking and that adults use it all the time, and that it was hardly inferior to abstract thinking. Moreover, there was a way to use hands-on, applied learning, where computers and other objects play a primary role, to master the most abstract of sciences, including mathematics. Papert articulated most of these ideas in the 1970s and early 1980s. But already in the late 1960s, Brody and Johnson were espousing this very philosophy. Tools and anti-environments, including the physical space of their lab, were a means of getting at abstract ideas related to ecology, complexity, and diversity. Brody and Johnson had no doubt that the most mundane of our interactions with everyday objects, the domain of concrete thinking, had the potential to awaken us to deeper truths. Truths about most abstract structures and processes. In other words, the usual dichotomy between concrete and abstract thinking, where the former is presented as inferior to the latter, did not exist for them. Chapter 3: Play and Playfulness. Once you grasp the delicate balance between assimilation and accommodation, and once you note how industrial civilization has tipped heavily towards the former, you can probably understand Brody and Johnson's emphasis on playfulness. Play and playfulness become crucial because they suspend our tendency towards assimilation, nudging us towards accommodation instead. They create spaces where we can develop new sensibilities, open ourselves to novelty, unlearn outdated ideas. Brody's work here shows influence of his friend Marshall McLuhan. McLuhan saw artists as sense makers, able to peer into the future and bring it into the present. Brody extends this idea to everyday objects, arguing that through play, we can suspend the usual scripts written into them. It's a deliberate rebellion against instruction manuals, against algorithmic thinking, As long as responsive technologies have no predetermined uses, they are indeed like toys. Just think about it. A broom can easily stand in for a horse. It all depends on our imagination. And in subverting the usual scripts and uses, perhaps we can find something new about these objects, about ourselves, about the world at large. Brody and Johnson also hope that a less goal-oriented and more playful attitude can help us recognize the invisible contacts that structure our lives. Art galleries and musical performances can certainly awaken us to them. But the bet made by Brody and Johnson was that everyday objects can do that too, as long as they are rendered truly responsive. For Brody, playfulness also releases us from the kind of automated, heavily patterned behavior that often prevents us from unlearning the obsolescent. And it's also a way of what he called reality testing, a way of checking whether our mental models of the world actually correspond to reality, or whether we have talked ourselves into denying their irrelevance and obsolescence. Toys and responsive technologies in general were just a way of enacting precisely this reality testing. Finally, we should not forget about the importance of ecology to Brody and Johnson's thinking. For them, the notion of ecology involved the idea that the effects of our technology use are not at all obvious or linear. There are effects of the second and even third degree. By triggering unexpected behavior, the sort of playful and responsive technologies that they were building were supposed to awaken us to this much longer chain of effects. In a sense, such an ecological conception of technology use is very close to current theories about the Anthropocene. It never loses sight of the person using technology and the broader systemic effect they're having. Sure, it might seem deeply unserious to expect that one could raise awareness of the consequences of technology use by making everyday objects more toy-like. But then again, we have hardly found a better way since. So, three cheers for playfulness. Chapter 4. Implications for design. Now that we understand why Brody and Johnson were so enthusiastic about playfulness, we can reflect upon what kind of technologies they favored, or at least what features they favored in their technologies. One key concept they celebrated in the lab has a strange name, eolithism. As you may have guessed, this term derives from Eolithic, which refers to the early part of the Stone Age, characterized by the use of crude stone tools. While the word Eolithic is widely used, Eolithicism is not. In fact, it comes from an essay by Hans Otto Storm, a German-American engineer turned novelist. He died in 1941. His essay, called Eolithism and Design, tells of an ancient man stumbling upon a stone. Its shape suggests that it might be suitable for a spearhead. So the man picks it up with that use in mind, but then he discovers that no, it's no good for the spearhead. However, then another use suggests itself. Maybe he can use it as a cooking or eating utensil. This simple stone, much like a toy, proves multi-purpose and adaptable, gaining new functions based on context. And the user's perceptiveness, of course. Here we are, back to the idea we discussed in the previous bonus episode. The idea that the richer and more responsive the environment in which we grow up, mature, and live, the more uses we would perceive in otherwise most mundane objects. Fascinated by the ideal of eolithism, Johnson and Brody wanted objects with high variability and low reliability. They envisioned creating tools and toys that adapt and change their function based on context, much like that stone in Storm's essay. This adaptability is crucial in a world where reality itself is constantly evolving. As a result, they also focused on materials that could change shape and function, an outgrowth of their belief that technology should evolve with us. No wonder they were so keen to pursue the development of soft control materials. These materials would ensure that flexible, truly responsive technologies could match our quest for endless becoming and evolving. Another essential aspect of their design philosophy was embedding an information layer into objects. This feedback would allow users to become more skilled and self-reflexive. This is something we mentioned in the previous bonus episode when discussing interfaces. For example, devices that monitor physiological data like body heat, pressure, and heartbeat can provide real-time feedback, giving us extra insight into our performance. Brody and Johnson believed that such feedback was very much like the helpful technical comments that a good teacher would provide. Thus, by interacting with such responsive technologies, we can become skilled practitioners in various fields. By now, you might be wondering about the features that Brody and Johnson wanted in their technologies. Well, they wanted their toys and objects free of any predictive systems. Brody and Johnson argued that building prediction into technology is often irrelevant and harmful due to the complexity and unpredictability of the world. Predictive systems have no way to account for nuance, leading to rigid and contextless interactions. Avery Johnson wrote with much disdain about the pitfalls of what he called deductive computing. Instead, Brody and Johnson favored technology systems that allowed for induction and abduction, approaches that could course correct based on feedback from the real world. Their technologies would be tested and shaped by reality too. Reality testing isn't just for humans. In summary, Johnson and Brody's ideal technologies would feature multi-purpose adaptability along the lines of eolithism. They would also provide feedback about one's performance, and they would rely on abductive and inductive reasoning, avoiding deductive approaches at all costs. Chapter 5: Tools and Toys. So the final big idea I'd like you to reflect upon is this notion of tools and toys coexisting. I believe it's one of the most revolutionary insights to come out of this lab, even though they struggled to communicate it clearly. Without delving into their extensive writings, essays, letters, and diaries, it's challenging to grasp just how this coexistence was envisioned. But we'll try nonetheless. A good place to start might be with an example frequently discussed in debates about artificial intelligence in the 1960s. A seemingly mundane piece of pre-AI technology, the hammer. There are several ways artificial intelligence could approach the task of automating the process of hammering. One method is to specify all the rules and procedures that we, humans, follow when we hammer. You know the drill. We find the hammer, search for the nail, lift the hammer, lower it, hit the nail, and repeat. These steps can be articulated clearly, and we can also give very precise descriptions of hammers and nails. And by defining everything at this level of detail, we start building a rule-based AI system. Eventually, it will know enough rules to differentiate hammers and nails from all the other objects, and to know the exact set of algorithms involved in hammering. This represents the traditional symbolic paradigm that dominated AI research in the 60s and early 70s. There is, of course, another approach that is much more familiar to us today. Instead of defining explicit rules, we could feed a system with vast amounts of data, images, videos, and texts about hammering. By analyzing this data, the system would gradually understand what hammers and hammering are, without being explicitly taught. This is deep learning based on neural networks. Many of the experiments leading to this approach began in the late 1950s and early 1960s. Despite some initial breakthroughs, the neural networks approach lost ground to symbolic AI and didn't see significant progress until the mid-1980s. At the time, the critics of AI weren't many, but those that did exist primarily complained about symbolic AI. They found its fixation on rules and procedures over context and spontaneity particularly inappropriate. Some of those critics drew on the work, much of it controversial, of the German philosopher Martin Heidegger. As it happens, he did write about hammers and hammering. For Heidegger, the latter is bound by context and tradition. It is something we master unconsciously, only paying attention to the hammer in our hand when it breaks down, It is only then that we become aware of the many contextual layers, hidden assumptions, and skills involved in the tool's use. Many of these skills are difficult to articulate. Our bodies learn and perform them, but they remain largely unspoken and implicit. Early critics of AI pointed out that teaching a computer all these contextual, tacit, and tradition-derived assumptions would be impossible. They argued that intelligence isn't confined to our brains. It's embedded in our culture and embodied in our actions. Thus, the very idea of building artificial intelligence seemed like a pipe dream. One of those early notable critics of AI was a philosopher named Hubert Dreyfus. In the 1960s, he engaged in heated debates with prominent figures in the world of AI, people like Marvin Minsky and Seymour Papert. Avery Johnson claimed to have coached Dreyfus in those debates. As it happens, Johnson himself had used the example of a hammer in his critiques of interfaces. This is not surprising, for Johnson and Brody more or less were in agreement with Dreyfus and Heidegger on one thing: our daily lives are structured by an invisible context. But here's where it gets truly interesting. In contrast to Heidegger, Brody and Johnson argued that having the hammer break down in our hands isn't the only way to reveal this hidden context. Playfulness and play can do that too. For example, using a hammer as a toy or for tasks it wasn't initially designed for can uncover the traditions, context, and tacit skills involved in its normal operation. Compared to the more mainstream critiques of artificial intelligence, the stance taken by Brody and Johnson stands out. It avoids defeatist and anti-technological attitudes. Instead of simply celebrating human uniqueness and marveling at the traditions that shape our everyday life, they advocate for a proactive and politically robust agenda that isn't technophobic at all. They argue that we need to build tools and environments that reveal the hidden artificiality of our technologies, of our institutions, and of the unexamined assumptions we hold about them. This way, we can revise and transform them. And the more we experiment with tools, yes, including those hammers, and the more we use them as toys, the more we learn about the world, about each other, and about the social and material ties that bind us. And who knows, we might even be lucky enough to eventually unlearn what has become obsolete. Brody and Johnson place great hopes in children for this very reason. There's something truly radical about how children constantly scrutinize truths we take for granted. They aren't yet caught up in the rigidities and abstractions of formal thinking. Instead, they happily assign new functions to objects based purely on imagination. That's the essence of play, right? For Brody and Johnson, toys are nothing but tools that have been liberated from their one-dimensionality and single function. They are tools that celebrate becoming, not efficiency. Through play, children discover new ways to grasp complexity. They uncover hidden relationships and factors that were previously deemed irrelevant. Don't miss the radical undertones in their train of thought. Take Heidegger's philosophy, for example. It obviously venerates tradition. Not so here with the visionaries of the Environmental Ecology Lab. Brody and Johnson encourage us to use technology to constantly question and, when necessary, revise and overthrow it. They see tradition as an obstacle to perpetual becoming, and they challenge it for good reason. What's notable here is that Brody and Johnson managed to translate their philosophy of becoming into principles of design. That's how they come to celebrate courteous technologies, intelligent environments, and soft architecture. Yet, the responsive objects are not just art. They are meant to be functional, not only conducive to reflection and contemplation, but to action, to getting things done. These objects, they are supposed to be toys and tools in one. It's not hard to see why. You see, for Brody and Johnson, play is never a separate activity, standing aside from working or living. No, playing, thinking, and working are one. Yet they are often kept separate through social, cultural, and technological boundaries. And non-responsive technologies play their part in maintaining that separation. In contrast, responsive technologies will transcend those limitations. Brody and Johnson certainly failed in their utopian quest. But as far as bold and ambitious projects go, theirs is truly impressive. So this is it. We've reached the end of this bonus episode, but also of the entire series. It's been quite a ride, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I did. If you crave more information about our protagonists, let me remind you that the website of the podcast contains many articles, photos, videos, and other materials. Do check it out. I'd like to thank the LEGO Foundation for a grant that helped me produce this podcast. I'd also like to extend special thanks to the Open Society Foundations for another grant that has aided me in promoting it. Many others have helped along the way, too many to list here, but thank you all nonetheless. If you've enjoyed the series, please leave a review on your favorite podcasting platform. And of course, it would be great if you could help spread the word in any other way you can. By the way, I do have another podcast series, The Santiago Boys. It tells the story of brave and utopian economists and engineers trying to build cybernetic socialism in Chile of the early 1970s. That's it for now. Thanks for listening.